Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hello and welcome to Florida Basketball Hour. I am Neil Blackman, Saturday Down South. On this episode, I got Eric Fawcett, GatorCountry.com, Basket Under Review. I guess I'm Basket Under Review now too, but Fawcett will be on. Got a lot to talk about today, man. You know, it's funny. It's rare. Like, sometimes we have these August episodes, and we're like, hey, what kind of questions do we even roll through for these episodes? And then other times, there's a lot to say, right? And it kind of becomes like, you know, how do we get this all into a 50-minute segment? So, fall camp questions for the Gators. I think probably going to come, normally I was going to say second, but we're going to go with that first. And then we will talk Denzel Aberdeen. We got to talk Wisney in the 10th Circuit's ruling today in favor of the NCAA. A lot of chaos there. What's the downstream ramifications of that? What do we know about the Denzel Aberdeen situation? Where does that kind of put Florida? And then, like, obviously that's something that's going to reverberate throughout college basketball, and you know, what does that look like? And then we're going to tier the SEC. I know Fawcett got into he got into making some tiers, I guess, pretty late yesterday. So I did some tiers too. And yeah, so that's how we're gonna roll on this episode of the show. Now, I guess, like, first questions, biggest questions, you know, we kind of broke down a little bit of how some of the rotations and minutes might end up looking, just from a bigger, grander perspective on the last show. And then we had, like, the Aberdeen asterisk. We'll talk about the Aberdeen situation. I know you guys want to have that discussion. But I think the reality is that Florida's kind of front court versatility is really not comparable. There's no one that compares to it nationally. I think the closest to it is probably actually in Florida's own conference in Texas, just because I think even though David Punch isn't really a three, he can play a lot of different positions and can guard a lot of different positions, and it gives you some versatility, particularly with the reclassification of Marcus Spears. I think that front court has some depth and some super nice pieces. Fawcett, I'm sure we'll talk about Texas on this episode. But I also think Florida, like, will play smaller this season at times. And I think one of the reasons that that probably is appealing to people is that, you know, we saw, even when Florida got into trouble in the Iowa game, how effective the Gators were at getting smaller and attacking when smaller. And I also think in many ways, like, some of the guys who you would really actually expect to take genuine leaps, you know, next year for Florida, are smaller guys, right? Isaiah Brown, obviously had really kind of transformed himself late in SEC play to where, really by the end of January and the Vanderbilt game, he kind of had his coming out party. But, you know, he really did transform himself as an impactful player from a guy who didn't play a DNP against Duke and a DNP against UConn last year to a guy who kind of came out of his shell with 9 points in the Georgia game at home and built on the trust from there, right, to the 14-point game against Vanderbilt. Really only had, like, I think maybe two kind of rough games in SEC play. The rematch against Vanderbilt, he was not very good. Nobody was. And then kind of struggled in the Auburn game on a night when pretty much everybody but Tommy Houck was bad. And I think, like, you know, when everybody but Tommy Houck is bad, this Florida team can still kind of hang around with the team that won the NIT on their home floor, but they weren't quite enough. It wasn't enough there in the tank to win that game. It's weird that Todd Golden has lost exactly one home game in each of the last three seasons. And it's even weirder that they've come against, I don't know, like kind of fringy. Like they haven't come against teams that are playing double byes in the SEC tournament. Like to me, I mean, there are like two grand mysteries in the Todd Golden era. And one is that he's 0-4 in SEC openers, probably going to be 0-5 unless Florida wins in Austin. Good luck. And then, you know, I know some guys on the staff listen, so, you know, I'm not hating too much. I'm just saying, like, the office in Birmingham didn't do Florida many favors by sending them to Austin, Texas to open their conference schedule. And then also, like, the fact that, yeah, I mean, Florida's home record is incredible. It's actually, I think, the second best in college basketball over the last 4 years. But nonetheless, like, the losses, none of them have been to, like, a double-bye team. But my point back on rotations and, like, sort of fall practice questions, to me it's like, who in fall practice, is it Isaiah Brown, is it CJ Ingram? Like, who gets the trust enough to where their sort of productivity becomes hard to ignore and then Florida can do the things I think they want to do, which is play Alex Connan a little more at the five, play Alex Connan in the short role a little more, play Tommy Houck a little more at the four. I mean, we could be succinct about it and just say, I think play smaller for 10 to 15 minutes a game. And I think Florida ends up being a little more multiple that way as fall practice begins.
Yeah, that'll be the interesting thing to change, like, or to see if there is change, because Florida's always been pretty confident in what they do and their process and how they play. And you kind of saw that as well with the way that they discussed after the Iowa loss, that they were still really happy with their game plan and how it was executed. Iowa just made some tough shots. And I mean, the one counter to that, I suppose, would be the fact that they were chased into playing small for the, I'll say first time. I mean, it probably wasn't the first time, but it's the first time I could remember in quite a while. So coming off of that kind of conversation, then bringing back so many of the same players, certainly interesting to see, okay, do they just feel like, hey, we were one seed again, got a tough matchup, which is always like kind of like a bit of a, I've heard that a couple of times, not from Florida staff, but other people say, oh, Florida ran into a tough matchup. Well, the tough matchup was a bunch of Horizon League players. So I don't really take that as a, like, if that's the tough matchup for you, I personally think you should have another plan in place. But that's just one of the things that Florida's been so confident in what they've been doing. Do they make the changes? But it has sounded like they're open to those kinds of adjustments, and I think that's good. And it just all kind of comes down to me to the same things. I think Houck will be better leveraged at the four. I think Connor will be better leveraged at the five, and I think that that is nothing negative to say about Ruben Chinyelu, who will still play a big role and still have play plenty. But I do think that some of those changes will be big. And I think my number one question that I'd be interested in, and I don't get many straight answers on it, and I understand why, but I've been the one who's kind of been critical of Florida's offense with the first shot. And obviously the offense rebound covers up all kinds of sins, but I've always been interested if, you know, deep down Florida's really, really content with their offense, not the offensive rebounding piece that saves a lot of it, or the shot making that saved it 2 years ago with Walter Clayton. But like, are they really satisfied? And they looked pretty similar this year to the year prior, which is understandable. They won a championship. They went and did the same things, but I think we'll find out pretty quickly if Florida feels like they need to make some changes. And I think that'll be really interesting watching some of these earlier matchups. And that's where it's nice that the Gators have what could turn out to be a super fun non-conference schedule, because we will get to see some of those changes. And I think too, adding in the two European guys coming in, both one that is a little bit older and probably more ready to play, and then one that's a little bit more upside, but might fit what the Gators look for a little more. I mean, that's going to be interesting too. And obviously, with most teams in most years, you are thinking about, oh, what do these new transfers look like? What does everyone look like? And that will not be the case for the Gators, who are quite the known commodity. Just before jumping on, I was reading the CBS Candid Coaches series. They had the who will be the best team. I know I just said I just read it now. I forget the exact number, but I think it was like 55% of coaches or something said the Gators. And I don't know if they did it last year after the Gators won the championship. It would be interesting to go back and see how many teams or how many coaches thought that the Gators would be the best team. But I don't think it was this many. So it's funny because they like won a championship, brought in some big name transfers. We know those transfers weren't quite what a lot of people thought, but and retained a lot of guys, but and everyone was like, oh, this team has a chance to repeat. But I don't think anyone was like, oh, this is like undoubtedly, clearly the best team in college basketball. Where this year, it'll be interesting to see exactly where the polls are. I know some people have been monitoring the advanced stats that are kind of yo-yoing between Duke and the Gators. This is, of course, just another sample size. It's coaches who are, as we know, very unreliable narrators when it comes to knowing the sport outside of their league. So I do take it with a massive grain of salt. It's actually funny. I kind of feel like oftentimes coaches are no less than a lot of fans about what goes on in college basketball. That's just going to be interesting. The Gators going in as someone who I think they're probably going to be number one. It's going to be interesting to see if Duke gets some kind of late surge of enthusiasm and if people want to have Duke number one, totally understandable. Don't think that's foolish, but you see some things where it just seems overwhelming that the Gators will have that kind of expectation to be the best team in the country. And that's something that could also be like, oh, well, like, let's just keep doing exactly what we've done the last 2 years. But I hope there's some hunger to make some changes. I think that that's the other thing that is, I would say, hopeful for Florida fans is this was a one seed last year where they clearly didn't hit home runs in the transfer portal. Not saying it was a disaster, but they didn't hit home runs. And they certainly weren't the most crisp offensive team, and they salvaged it. So they're still like very clear areas that they could get better. And that's where you see, oh yeah, this could be like two championships in 3 years.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think that's all kind of where I come down. One thing that I've been pointing out, and, you know, it's something, if you've listened to Florida Basketball Hour for a long time, or you subscribe to patreon.com/Florida Basketball Hour, the Patreon, still the best way to support the show, and I'll get to that in a second, but if you either subscribe or you've listened to us for a few seasons, like, you know that both Eric and I have been pretty consistent about, like, the myth of the leap, and, like, this idea that, oh, well, Thomas Houck returned and, like, last year he was a fringe lottery pick, so now he's going to be, like, unequivocally a National Player of the Year candidate. And, like, maybe he will be a National Player of the Year candidate, but, like, you know, I think it's all very marginal, the extent that, like, he's going to be more productive than he was last year when he was already an All-American productive level player, right? Alex Condon, I think he's kind of one I would maybe put of the three, Chinyelu, Condon, and Houck. The one I think has the most room to where you could say, oh, wow, his senior year was a little bit better than everything else before, at least for me, is Condon. Because I think he can shoot the ball a little more consistently. Maybe I'm really naive in believing that. And I also just think that Florida can play through him and put him in better positions to succeed. Like, I just think that offensively there are things that Florida can do, including putting him in the short role a lot more, that I think will be more effective than some of the stuff we've seen in the past. I also think I looked at the CBB analytics numbers just the other day and noticed that Alex Condon is in the 98th percentile, basically on any type of shot from 15 feet in. I mean, or Florida's offense when Condon gets a paint touch. Very similar, like, efficiency levels. So the idea that, like, Florida always played the right way with Alex Condon last year, I think I would reject that a little bit and think, I think there are better ways that they can kind of deploy Condon and he could be more effective. But in terms of like Ruben Chenula, like I actually think playing smaller more, I mean, I talked about this a little bit earlier in the summer. I forget whether it was on a Patreon, but like, if you think Ruben Chenula is going to like play 30 minutes a game instead of 25, like you might be surprised. Like, I don't think that's the outcome. I think Ruben's minutes probably stay about the same. And that's a good thing because the way that Chenula plays and how hard he plays is why he's so good. Right. I mean, he's a 6'9" dude with a 7'6" wingspan who can guard point guards. I mean, you don't want him to like, you don't need him to play 30 minutes, right? You need him to play 25 minutes really hard. And that's what makes him special. But I don't think like Ruben launching threes is something that a wrinkle that this offense really needs, right? It might be something Ruben thinks is fun to show NBA scouts. And I'm sure you're going to grimace a few times in non-conference play. But I doubt that there's a lot of that getting launched in SEC play. So in terms of the front court, like, I just don't think there's a lot of guys making, you know, like the leap isn't – junior, senior leap is going to be minimal. So who can make a leap? It's like Isaiah Brown. It's CJ Ingram. It's does Alex Lloyd carve out a role, depending on Denzel Aberdeen, which I already promised people. I would talk about the legality and what the hell's going on. But I wanted to talk about this fall camp stuff first because this is what I get DMs about.
Yeah, that's I think the last interesting piece is like, do we see Domen Petrovic getting into the action? That's a player that I know we just constantly will talk about Patreon content throughout our podcast, and especially in the off season when we're especially in the off season when we're doing 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 Patreon posts for every podcast. It's easy to have those 7 or 8 posts to cite back, but that is where the Patreon is great, just to get eyes on these guys from Europe that you're not gonna be able to see anywhere else. And I thought that was, of course, the interesting piece where it's just big for me to just explain, like, these are not the same style of player, just in that one is a traditional kind of like high school player and one is essentially a graduate transfer. And so, you know, Petrovic is someone that I think is brings a little bit of shooting that the Gators could desperately need. And I think that that's what's going to be interesting as well, is that his minutes at the four, where I think he's kind of locked at, I think he's a little undersized for the five, and with the like the Gators don't need more fives. I know there's even still some like Mikic truthers out there that are ready to say that he's going to be getting minutes at the five. So like but what the Gators could need is shooting. And while they are comfortable not getting that shooting from the four, as we have seen, it's just fact of the matter is if they're not getting the shooting they require from the backcourt, Petrovic is someone who shot, I forget if it was 37-38% in Slovenia on good volume last year. So he's just like, you know, legit shooter, 22 years old. So that makes the front court conversation interesting. Just that I feel like his minutes are not as going to be even as contingent on the front court rotation as it might be in the backcourt rotation. If it's still Boogie Fland is a below average 3-point shooter, and Aberdeen, whose 3-point shooting is maybe something to even be discussed. Maybe that could come after you give your legal updates, which I do know everyone is excited for. And another popular piece of the Patreon is anytime Neil starts breaking down what's going on around the legal side of things. But I think that remains somewhat of a question for the Gators. Of course, when you is a 3-point shooting, when you have a year that you don't shoot the three very well and you kind of bring everyone back, the one possible insertion of new shooting is Petrovic. Will that be, you know, it's possible other guys get better, but I think that's kind of the clear angle to see it. So I definitely recommend people go watch that video on Patreon and get a feel for him. I do really like his game. I would also say, for the Gators to go in and get him, not that he was, you know, terribly expensive, not like he's getting paid like a starter, but the Gators went and paid him well and got a 22-year-old. And you don't really get 22-year-olds to be like that are good and pay them a decent amount to just not factor in. So I do feel like he's going to be someone in the mix. And then you can start kind of doing the math from there, where like, I think he's locked at the four. I think the Gators want to get Houck more minutes at the four, and then we know the center rotation is going to be Chinyelu and Connan. We have a good idea. So you can probably start to do the math a little bit there, and that becomes interesting. But that'd be the guy to watch.
So a lot of his stuff in the videos, patreon.com/40BBR. They'd set the banner there. Still the best way to support our show. I don't know why I clicked off the banner. There is the banner. There's 3 membership levels. Check it out. Please support us. Our sponsor for the podcast remains Game Time Sidekicks. I don't have any of the awesome like Gettys in front of me right now because I'm traveling for actual like NIL stuff, as it turns out. But in any event, go to GameTimeSidekicks.com. If you spend $60, you can get a free koozie in time for football tailgating season. A lot of energy in that building. I was around last week. John Sumrall, he's a different kind of cat. We'll see if it works. I feel like he has none of the flaws that some of the previous hires had, but, you know, whether that makes it work or not is to be determined. You see some of my football stuff over at Saturday Down South. Also, you'll see both of our work at Basket Under Review, but the real way you can help keep Florida Basketball Hour going as we move into year 8, which is really hard to believe.
Wow.
as we move into year 8 of Florida Basketball Hour, is to subscribe to patreon.com. Now, couple little early fall kind of practice notes, and then I'll talk about the Aberdeen stuff that everybody wants to hear about. Boogie Fland, 10 pounds bigger, looks stronger, shooting farther away. I don't know if that's like, you know, I think consistency from just beyond the line would be what most people are hoping. Definitely been working on, you know, some length to the jump shots as well. I think some of that is that if he can knock down one from a foot or two farther, he is so quick and so effective at getting in the paint that anytime you can lift a defense a little more for somebody like that, that's probably a good thing. Isaiah Brown continues to turn heads pretty much everywhere that he has been. And then there's a Patreon coming this week on Alex Condon and how he got to play with the Aussie national team. This is the kind of stuff you're not going to get anywhere else. I might let Fawcett talk a little bit about like what he saw from Condon there, but you can see it on the Patreon. I would say the very, very rough early notes are just that everything with Houck does look more consistent from deep, which was really like he said that and the left hand were like his two priorities. Boogie Flan just stronger and healthier, which I think is a huge story because as we pointed out a lot, like it's hard to believe that he just turned 20 because, you know, most players his age are already 21. And I think just kind of catching up physically for him and then being healthy, was huge. And I would point out that like the last month of the season from the big rout of Oklahoma to the Iowa game, he shot 38% from three, which was a little more in line with like his high school numbers. I think we remember sort of the loud air ball against Iowa and forget that there were a lot of good moments in that last month for him offensively.
Yeah, well, I have been the number one Fland supporter, I feel, even going back to when the Gators got him. And I feel like I was the one who was like, hey, I know everyone's getting really hyped about the Savion Lee guy, but I think Fland is the much better pickup. Now, I don't think it netted out that he was the much, much better pickup. I would still say, like, in my opinion, I would say that Fland had a better season. There's no real sense in litigating that, but if you've got a take, Neil, you're welcome to throw it in. But like he was someone that I thought was like, I was definitely a believer going in, and maybe that's my bias and that's why I am still supporting him. But I do feel like he played such a massive role to the defense that, and I feel like everyone knows that Florida's defense was awesome, and I feel like a lot of the credit has gone to Chinyelu. And rightfully so, he was fantastic. I feel like a lot of the credit came to Houck and Connan. I mean, sure, they're very important, but like Fland just absolutely hounding the opposing team's point guard who has the ball for most of the game. I thought played a huge role in Florida's defense. He also was kind of the one player to create turnovers and those run out layups that the Gators don't get a ton of, just because they don't force a ton of turnovers. They play rather conservatively defensively. And of course that works. And it was when the Gators were kind of playing conservatively and not giving up anything at the rim. And then once a game, you've got Boogie Flanders, like clean stripping guy for that layup. I thought that was massive. And yeah, the age piece is pretty crazy. When you see players roughly his age that are coming into college as freshmen right now, and the experience I that he's already had. And then the health piece too. It's one of those things that's always so hard to quantify from the outside, because again, he still played well last year. It wasn't like it was an absolute disaster. And you'd be like, well, of course it's a disaster. Look how hurt he is. And that's always tough for players as well, where it's like, oh, they're still playing a ton of minutes. They're still like, they're in the fight. Like, it's hard to be like, sometimes it can be hard to be like, oh yeah, like, are they injured? But like, I don't know. Looked like he was, you know, looks like guys are pretty healthy out there. So it's always impossible to say. It's also one of those things where it's very specific to the 3-point shooting. It takes only a small tweak for shooting to go very poorly. And anyone who's even went to open gym or church league or men's league, and like, just knows that like, oh, if the ball comes off your finger just a little bit wrong, your shot might be spinning like a globe and it's an air ball. So it just there, that's the other piece about any injuries, is that like, yeah, it doesn't take much to really mess up a jump shot. So, which I actually was thinking, potentially I'll need to do this on the Patreon, going back a little bit to his stuff pre Arkansas, pre college, taking some film and see what his jump shot looked like versus what it looked like at Arkansas versus what it looked at Florida. I definitely did one on the Patreon where we looked at some of his shooting at last year, Florida. And I mean, man, it's a little tough because he got good looks and his form doesn't look terrible. And then often the shot was not close to going in. And that's one of those things where sometimes you look at guys with terrible form. And that's something even with like an Alex Condon. I think you look at Alex Condon's form, it could use refinement. So it's when you see him missing poorly, but his mechanics aren't great. Well, you're like, oh, well, like clearly there is changes to be made. And if he makes those, you can kind of clearly see why he could become a better shooter. With Flan, that becomes a little bit more difficult. But yeah, it's something that I feel like he could be one of the best defenders in the country at his position this year. That would be huge if the Gators have some other ability to make shots around him. In another world, I feel like if there's shooters around him, suddenly like it's like, oh yeah, like it's a thing that he can't shoot, but it's not, you know, a huge deal. Like thinking about when like the Gators were good around Casey Hill, people stopped talking about Casey Hill shooting, not stopped talking, but it was less of a story. When the Gators weren't as good and Casey Hill's missing shots, well, suddenly like, oh my goodness, that's terrible. So that'll be kind of something that's easy to monitor. Cause I do think in a lot of ways you could look at Flan's exact season last year. And if he shoots 32% from three, like, I'm not saying he shoots it great, he just shoots it slightly below average. Like, I think a lot of people are like, wow, that was actually like an awesome season. And I think the one thing that I noted when the Gators got Flan that he got a lot better at was when he was at Arkansas, he really struggled to finish at the rim. And we definitely saw him get a lot better in that area. He's not great there, but he's much better. And that was kind of the problem at Arkansas, was he was athletic and quick enough to get to the rim. And then he would leave a lot of points there. And when he was blowing by guys and Chinelu ceiling, like, yeah, he was, you know, finishing confidently. And I think that was a big piece of the improvement. And he still has some other room to get better there. So I'm pretty high on Flan entering this season.
Yeah, me too. I think got a real decent chance to be an all-SEC player when all is said and done. And I think in this league, we'll talk about it at the end of the show, that would be really impressive. Okay, I know a lot of people want to know what the hell's going on. So, Denzel Aberdeen. I guess the easiest thing to say is, like, Florida's still waiting on the waiver. Like, so for the second time that there's been a giant court decision, like, these graphics have been wrong. Like, the first time Pete Nakos was like, Denzel Aberdeen is eligible. And it was like, well, Yeah, in the sense that, like, there is currently a court order, which the NCAA is going to appeal immediately, that makes him eligible. And I actually thought it was weird that guys like Pete Nakos and stuff ran with it, because I get it. But, you know, that's like the classic example of the race to be first journalism right now, where it's like, no, he's not eligible. He's eligible pending an appeal. Well, the NCAA won the appeal today, 2-1. We're recording on Friday afternoon. It was a 2-1 decision by the 10th Circuit Court of Appeal to stay the injunction. That means that they paused the injunction, making all the players that were eligible ineligible pending the appeal. Doesn't mean that they lost forever, by the way. And the appeal could be resolved in November, and then all those players could become eligible in November or December or October. But in any event, the you can play right away portion of the case, which was the injunction, that's been stayed by the 10th Circuit Court of Appeal. They didn't give much reasoning, to be honest. They issued a very short order, and they just said, we stay the injunction, and it's a 2-1 decision. So we don't get a lot from that. It is interesting that it was 2-1, and there was one judge who would have denied the NCAA's motion to stay. Usually that stuff is unanimous. Like 95% of the time, that type of thing is unanimous. That's pretty interesting. I don't know if it bodes well or not for the NCAA on appeal. Here's the thing. I don't think it's going to matter. That gets into kind of like, how do I want to explain this? And I thought about this a lot since the Wisnay thing came out. I think the easiest way to explain it is like, what happens? What's the impact of this getting stayed on all of college basketball? And then let's talk about Aberdeen. On all of college basketball, we are in a really weird spot right now where I honestly think it's the worst case scenario. And I was one of the people who tweeted that this could possibly happen and that it would be very bad. And I actually honestly kind of thought maybe the stay would get denied because the lawyers for the athletes in Wisnay kind of argued that it could be bad. And I don't think the court really evaluated that very thoroughly, because here's what's happened. A lot of players are already eligible because they have state court orders. And state court orders, like the federal court not saying that everybody is eligible, doesn't mean that state judges are prohibited from saying some players are eligible. So what's happening is in state courts, players are winning over and over and over and over and over again. And the reason they're winning over and over again is because the NCAA made a bad decision, at least from a legal standpoint. You could totally agree with the NCAA from a competitive standpoint. I'm just talking about the law. From a legal standpoint, it was absolutely arbitrary to exclude the 2022 class from a fifth year when you gave one to the 2023, 2024, and 2025 classes. Because all those classes signed a letter of intent expecting to play 4 years, to have 5 years to play four, right? So when you gave an extra year to three of those classes, but not one, that's arbitrary. And that exclusion has been considered unlawful under the state law, not federal law, of a bunch of states. Georgia, Missouri, California, Kentucky 20 minutes ago, Louisiana, you know, all kinds of places, Texas, and I'm forgetting plenty of others. So what does that mean? It means that we're now in a scenario where a lot of players are going to be eligible through state-level injunctions, but that eligibility is going to be dictated by different state courts and potentially on different schedules, right? Like Kentucky just named Mark Mitchell eligible to play, among other people. Fascinating that he went to court in Kentucky. you know, like, and the different schedules part is the NCAA could appeal each and every one of these decisions and duke it out. And they're probably going to win occasionally, and they're probably going to lose occasionally. They won in Ohio last week, but they sort of lost because they had already lost the substance of the case. And the Ohio court ordered an expedited appeal. What does that mean? Well, it means that that appeal will be decided by October when practice starts, right? Under their procedural rules. So that's what I mean by different schedules. Like, if the NCAA appeals and they win stays, then it'll be how long does it take to decide the appeal? So, again, players could be getting eligible in January, in February. Now, who holds roster spaces for these players, etc.? Those are our separate questions. Mortal Jim asked, isn't Mark Mitchell in the same situation as Bediako? No. And that's the other thing that's been going on is – a lot of these courts have granted relief for 2022 players because, unlike, say, Charles Bediako, these guys signed because they didn't know what their status with the NCAA was. So they had no choice but to sign these things. And if they would have been eligible, what they're arguing is, I wouldn't have signed this. And courts are saying, you know what? That's right. You didn't have a free choice to sign it because the NCAA had declared you ineligible. So the real question is, are you ineligible fairly or legally, or should you actually have eligibility? And then the NCAA is saying, well, if Mark Mitchell had eligibility, it's reasonable for him to argue he wouldn't have signed an Exhibit 10. Same argument Micah Hanlockton just made, right? So, and the arguments in court are different in federal court and state court. I don't want to get any deeper in the weeds on the law than I have. But essentially, like, the state court arguments are the NCAA's rules are arbitrary. And that there are third-party beneficiaries of contracts that they signed who are the – and that their right as third-party beneficiaries has been damaged by the NCAA's arbitrary application of the five-year rule, right? The federal law stuff is antitrust law. So those are different types of claims. And so that's why you could lose your antitrust argument and still be eligible in state court. Plus there's a bunch of state laws. The point is everything is different. Tanner asked, do people realize why most people hate lawyers? I mean, I get the jokes and like, that's fine. And I don't take it as a personal attack. It's a privilege to sue the NCAA in some of these cases. I am doing that in multiple cases right now, and I don't feel bad about it. Like, Tanner, the NCAA drew a stupid rule. They applied it arbitrarily. They excluded an entire class of kids that the text of the rule should apply to, and I don't feel bad about them not doing their job right. And protecting kids – and adults, a lot of these guys are obviously adults, but protecting their like right and their ability to make a living when they should be able to do that does not make me feel bad. And if people hate me for that, that's fine. Like, I'll be just fine. The NCAA should do a better job. And by the way, if you have competitive issues with this, like, I'd love to hear your explanation for why COVID waivers were fair to the class of 2022 when they were freshmen, but now you're suddenly concerned about freshmen in 2026. But even if you can explain that, like, why couldn't the NCAA just draft a rule that didn't give 2023, 2024, 2025 a fifth year? Just say it's a prospective rule and moving forward, everybody's going to get a fifth year. And then the problem is solved. Because no court is going to say it's arbitrary when it applies to high school kids, right? They're just going to say, hey, you guys came before this, and that's that. And I think the NCAA's legal position is much stronger in that scenario. So I appreciate this, Tanner, but it's really – I have a hearing on another temporary injunction Monday, and I hope we win because that kid deserves to play. And that's where I'm at on these things. Okay. Aberdeen. Florida hasn't got an answer on the waiver yet. And this is a really interesting one because, and I'm sure Fawcett's heard this too, like there are coaches who literally were advised by lawyers, which may be a reason that people hate lawyers, to sue the NCAA rather than go through the waiver process. And I think Florida smartly did not do that. And I think there are two reasons that that's smart. One, Aberdeen still might get the waiver. I think he should. The player, I brought this up on a Patreon, but I think there is a very good, sorry, I'm looking up his name. And I should have written this down before. Yeah. If Justice Ajigbar was eligible to play for St. Joe's last year, then Denzel Aberdeen should be eligible. The reason that Ajigbar was named eligible, and by the way, he was playing his sixth year because he got a COVID year. The reason he was eligible was because he played minimally as a freshman at Harvard. So if 35 minutes at Harvard all played in March are sufficient, then Aberdeen should get a waiver, at least in my opinion. And if he doesn't, it's arbitrary. And that second part, it's arbitrary, is why it's smart for Florida to wait. It's smart for Aberdeen to wait. Florida isn't the one suing. It would be Aberdeen. And I think Aberdeen's legal team, whoever they are, it isn't me. I have not been asked to do this. I get that message a lot. When are you suing for Aberdeen? I am not Denzel Aberdeen's lawyer. and, you know, I hope it's Heitner because he's like 7,000-0, honestly. But, you know, if it's not, whatever. In any event, if they wait on the waiver, they have two arguments they can make. They also, and I said there were two reasons, then strategically, their first argument is that 5 for 5 should apply to the class of 22. Their second argument is that it's arbitrary to deny his waiver. But additionally, the longer you wait, the longer it takes the NCAA to appeal, and then Aberdeen gets to play. So I do think there's a sweet spot where you don't want to like wait too long and then like it be the day of the Duke game and some court stays a temporary restraining order and suddenly Denzel Aberdeen can't play against Duke, right, until his appeal is resolved. Like, I think, you know, that's an interesting scenario. But my point is, like, there are still two paths for Aberdeen to play. One is to get the traditional waiver. The second is to get a state court injunction. Really, there's a third. It's that the athletes win Wisnay on appeal during college basketball season. But Denzel's a degree-seeking student, so we'll see, like, what happens with him. But, no, you're going to see some bad graphics. There's already one that Field of 68 posted where they're like, players ineligible after Wisnay. And it's like, no, this is not – this stuff is not resolved. It's not even close to resolved. And that's part of why it's such a mess. Sorry. Thanks for tolerating that, Fawcett.
No, I think you should keep going. I mean, I was good. And yeah, I don't think you should group yourself in with the genre of lawyers that some people dislike. But yeah, I mean, I do find the, like, this is why it is difficult to me and why precedent is difficult, because yes, I feel you could, like, you just cited one example of a guy that got a waiver that, like, again, would be somewhat consistent to Aberdeen, but there's also guys that played more than that, or less than that, and didn't get a waiver. So that's where I feel like that's part of the reason why everyone hates the NCAA's rulings, is that there doesn't seem to be precedent. At the same time, I don't want to start talking like a lawyer, because that's where that's why you're here. And as people probably know, that's why I try to really stick to the stuff I feel like I'm an expert in, and don't talk about stuff I don't. That's why you don't get my college football takes. But I will say, as a just outsider looking in, I still do think the funniest thing that the NCAA does, that to me just seems to undermine every argument they make, is when they're out there talking about how they need an antitrust exemption from the Senate. It's like, how do you argue that you need an antitrust exemption and then say, oh, but what we're doing isn't a breach of antitrust? It's like, well, do you need the exception or not? So while everything is going on, and like you said, denying guys the opportunity to make money, and I mean, like, I do think that when people think about high major basketball, and maybe rightfully so, and you're seeing these guys that have made millions and are looking to get more millions, I think that there's a certain level of sympathy that guys lose once they get into seven figures of revenue for themselves. But, you know, talking about guys making a living, like, I mean, I really saw this straight up. And with the Mark Mitchell example that was given, like, as much as I do think a lot of cases that are made in terms of waivers are often done in, like, maybe saying they're done in bad faith is, or arguments are made in bad faith. Maybe that's too strong of wording, but, you know, I think that sometimes people make arguments that I, you know, maybe I half believe, and I think they half believe, but, like, it is very clear that Mark Mitchell would not have signed that contract if he didn't have that opportunity. And there are many players in that boat. People know my season in Canada, where I coach professionally, it runs in the summer. We had a guy that left his school on the West Coast. He was a class of 2022 who played his 4 years and thought his eligibility was done, and signed with us and started and was in Edmonton on May 1st to start playing professional basketball. Now, since he started to, he very clearly would not have done that if he thought he was coming back to, if he was going to have a fifth year of eligibility. And quite frankly, if he was going to go back to college, he would make seven times more, if not more, than what he made with us. And he's now in a situation too, that he was playing with us in the summer, that he is, he also started to realize that, oh, this might be happening. So he also said no to a bunch of offers overseas. Now, this is a guy that his opportunities would not be in the Exhibit 10 range. This would be going to Europe and making $50,000 or $60,000, but he has said no. And that's the other thing people don't know. Like, a lot of leagues in Europe, if you're going to go play overseas, they want you there either in some of the top leagues on August 1st, many other leagues in the second or third week of August. So pretty much most leagues in Europe right now, their players are on campus. Now, this player who is, you know, waiting on his fifth year of NCAA eligibility ruling is unsure if he's, or, well, he said no to a bunch of opportunities to go make money overseas. And this is, again, a guy that made very low six figures last year in NIL. So, which, again, some of you will hear that and say, like, oh, well, that's a ton of money. I don't really have sympathy for him. But, you know, it wasn't millions. It was very, very low, but into the six figures. If he were to return, you know, maybe double that, but still, you know, low six figures. And, like, yeah, for him, that is, and where he came from in Canada, that is huge money. Like, that is like the truest example of, like, making a living and, like, the opportunity. Now, he's also Canadian, and some people might also have questions about how this, you know, does he need to be given the right to make an earning in another country? And maybe that brings up other stuff too, but I've just seen it firsthand where it's like, yeah, it's very obvious he wouldn't have signed a pro deal if he knew that he was going to have another year of eligibility or could. And Mark Mitchell is another one where I feel like that one's, like, pretty obvious. So that's one where or you mentioned Micah Hamlock, and same kind of deal. Like, that's like extreme. Like, anyone, I logically, I don't think anyone could see anything different. It's so rare now that guys would forego eligibility for one of those small contracts. So, yeah, but I appreciate you breaking it all down. I think you said you didn't want to go into any more into the weeds. I think if you wanted to, people would love to listen to it. And I mean, you also touched on it. I don't think a lot of media companies have covered themselves in glory when it comes to covering the developments. And again, a little bit of just a pet peeve to me. I think that people should stick to what they are experts at and try not to talk out of turn on things. And by people just, like, jump, like, you know, it's how many times this summer have we seen, oh my goodness, everyone's eligible. And then, oh my goodness, no one's eligible. And it's like, this is like the fifth time that everyone just keeps jumping to one end of the extreme or the other. And I'll be honest, Neil, like, I'm just at the point where I'm just waiting for the dust to settle. Like, every time I hear this state said this state said this player got out, like, I just haven't believed any of it. And I'm just waiting for the final buzzer. Like, to me, this is like people following this. It's like people looking at, like, a KenPom win probability chart, or it's like the hardcore, most hardcore basketball fan of whatever their team, and their team goes down 8-2 3 minutes in the game. They're like, well, it's over, we lost. And then they go up by eight before the first half ends, and they're like, okay, we won it. And, like, it's just that, like, jerking back and forth that people just seem to love to do. Yeah, as these updates have come, as I saw, oh, look, you know, Aberdeen is not, like, I just, it moved me 0%. I'm just waiting for, like, logic presumably is going to win out at the end of this thing, whatever that is. So I am just at the point where I'm kind of numb to all the updates. I am numb to the graphics being put out by the various people that are cosplaying as lawyers. I'm happy to have you explain it, because I just actually have not really cared to look into any of the last couple of stories, because I've been just waiting on waiting on the actual ruling. Now, it was also funny, of course, when Aberdeen I'll say got eligible at one point, you know, a bunch of people were like, you know, pointed out, Neil, that it was now Neil one and Eric zero on the Aberdeen thing. And I was like, maybe I should have put caveats and just been like, oh, well, like my thing was just on the waiver. And like, so we'll see there, which I still could end up being very wrong on. But that's ultimately, I think people, like, if you look into it, I still think that's just my problem with, just going back to the first thing I said, it's just like the precedent thing just seems to be non-existent, which I'm sure just makes your skin crawl as a lawyer when precedent is just doesn't seem to apply in these NCAA cases. And I also think that's why a lot of people are struggling to follow this story, because state court, federal court, not the same as NCAA clearinghouses. We're dealing with very different levels of scrutiny here. So,
yeah,
I think that's also what people are struggling with.
No, I think that's right. And I mean, like, lawyers, we struggle, at least in one of the cases that we're appealing the waiver denial, and then we're making a 5-for-5 argument. So we like that, because we say he should be eligible anyway. We don't care what you think about 5-for-5. But if you don't think he should be eligible, he should be eligible. And our argument on the waiver is, like, they denied this medical waiver. And in the case summaries, I don't know if anybody's ever seen these waiver forms, but, like, so they've got, like, why they made the decision. And then there's a section called precedent for our decision. And in their denial, they're like, based on our case history and precedents, this is a reason to not give this waiver. And then the case precedent is entirely blank. Like, they cite no precedent whatsoever. And then I'm not one of these people that's like, oh, The Wire is the greatest show of all time or anything. But there is a funny scene in The Wire. It's a great show. But there is a funny scene where Stringer Bell is at a meeting with his fellow drug traffickers. And somebody's writing down stuff. And Stringer Bell says, I can't believe you're taking notes on a mother effing criminal conspiracy. And, like, the NCAA released a memo in 2022 where they instructed their staff to deny waivers whenever possible. So it's kind of like we go into court and we're like, here's what they said that they want their people to do. And here's our waiver where there's zero precedent cited, even though they said based on our precedents, we have to deny this. And, like, what is a judge supposed to do in that scenario? Like, I explain your decision. So, like, Aberdeen's would be weird because, to Eric's point, they would have precedents to say this is where we denied it. And then there's at least one that I found where they got it. So then if your Aberdeen's lawyers are like, well, this is pretty arbitrary, and you're right about that. But I don't know. I think Florida, and no, the NCAA hasn't issued winter sports waivers yet, as far as I know, Jim. But, yeah, they would have to answer soon. And so I think Aberdeen's, like, next move comes pretty soon. But I also think, you know, Todd Golden and those, like, the staff would probably love to start practice knowing. Like, because I think it dictates what happens with Isaiah Brown's minutes and what happens with Alex Lloyd's minutes, most of all. And CJ Ingram's a little bit. But mostly Zay, who I think is getting overlooked in, like, the two guard discussion. And then, like, you know, Lloyd. So we'll see. Aberdeen would make Florida a lot better. I don't think there's any question about that, especially on defense. I think Florida has a chance to be, like, a Houston caliber of good on defense. I don't think that's a hot take if Aberdeen plays. And I think if he doesn't, they don't quite have that ceiling defensively because Urban Klavsar is Urban Klavsar, and like I love him and he tries hard, but he isn't like a gifted defender. And so, you know, that's kind of where Florida is. And that's where the lawsuits are. More of this stuff on the Patreon. Maybe I'll get more into it. I've been posting updates when I can. Eric has something cool coming up on like SEC trends too. And like kind of what way people went in the portal. I mean, to me, and we can do tiers now as we kind of wrap up. I don't know if Eric even wrote yours down. I've got mine. I'm going to share my screen. This could be kind of fun. If I can figure out where... Oh, there we go. Yeah. So these are my tiers. I made five and then really a six tier that has a huge asterisk based on everything that Fawcett and I were just talking about. I call it the courtroom drama tier, which is LSU, who currently has four players again. They had gotten up to five, and then Wisney came out, and so Sky Clark is ineligible, even though he might not be. Anyway, so LSU's back to four players. We'll see. We'll see what happens with them. So those are – these are my tiers, though. And – I mean, maybe the best way to do this is to make it actually quick so we don't have to go through it all, is just to go back and forth. Like, and Fawcett, if you guys listen to his show with Kevin Sweeney, if you don't, you should. But they just did a great one on Texas. Like, I think Texas is in the tier with Florida. Like, I think they are a national championship contender. I know I am really, really leaning into Isaiah Johnson with that take. But, like, I love David Punch. I think he's awesome. I think Marcus Spears, like, if you're going to get a really good freshman, like, getting one that doesn't have to be awesome is almost always the, like, that was Bradley Beal's kind of scenario, and, like, it worked for him. There are plenty of other examples. I just use Beal because it's a Florida show. I think Marcus Spears is going to be helpful. Vokatidis, is the hook and hold king, but he's also gotten better at other stuff. He's a pretty good player. And like, I just think that front court is really great. I don't know how much I'm in love with the back court, but it's good enough to me to put them in a tier with Florida.
Yeah. So just for, yeah, the audio listeners, yeah, Florida and Texas in Neil's tier one. So yeah. Texas is just like on the cusp for me. So I'm certainly okay with you putting them in there. I think that generally I'm just like, I feel like the Punch love has gotten a little high. I think he's really good, but I feel like I don't know. I'm probably not quite as high. And I feel like there's a little bit of redundancy with just his game and Vokatidis's game, which I do love Vokatidis. I really love Johnson, the point guard from Colorado, which I know people love throwing around most underrated player in the country in college basketball. Cause like, it's impossible to watch everyone. I do think that Johnson might've been in that conversation for most underrated player just because he was on Colorado. That was just bad. Like, no, what, they weren't bad enough that everyone watched to like hate watch, but they were, the reason they were like a top 70 KenPom team and not like 140th is because of Johnson largely. I do think he's fantastic. Yeah. So I might have Texas tier two. They're like really close to me, but if we're truly being like, these are teams that win the national championship, like that's where I just fall short. I will say, however, I would put Tennessee in my tier one. Okay. Neil has them in tier two. I'm going to say I have Tennessee in tier one. Quick. We don't want to take this. I know you said you want to be quick, but Tennessee, just like the portal hall of all portal halls. Now it's a little bit more, there's a lot of names and I wish that they consolidated that a little bit more. I think people will all know that I'm pretty consistent in my kind of take that I would rather teams be top heavy and really concentrate their assets versus spread them out. But Tennessee getting Juke Harris, who is one of the biggest names in the portal, over 20 points per game at Wake Forest may have been the reason why Dusty May left for the NBA. If you follow that story, Data Ames, one of the best guards in the portal. Tyler Lundblade, one of the best shooters in the portal. Terrence Hill from VCU, fantastic downhill point guard. Jalen Washington, who was at Vanderbilt. Miles Rubin, really good player at Loyola Chicago. Brayden Liu, who's one of the like really trendy mid-major undersized centers. And then Jalen Harrelson is like the like seventh player that most people talk about when it comes to their portal class, and he was 16 points per game at Notre Dame. Like they are so deep. And the other thing too is they went, which this is interesting, Tennessee went all offense with their portal picks.
Finally
Rick Barnes was like, hey, I'm kind of tired of playing rock fights all the time. So he just brought in like seven elite. Like if Terrence Hill went to the Gators, I think people would be like, oh my God, this is going to be one of the best guards in the SEC. And he's just like kind of like a guy in their class. Like Data Ames, massive score. I haven't said like Juke Harris, 20, over 20 points per game at Wake Forest. Like Tyler Lemblade, best shooter. They're going to have him running off all the screens like they've always loved from shoot. Like, so yeah. It's like one thing, it's like, okay, now what if Tennessee actually had scores is the thing. But also a lot of these guys like Juke Harris cannot guard. Tyler Lemblade is okay. Their centers don't really guard. They're okay. So it's on one hand, I'm like Tennessee might have just lost their identity, but they also brought in just an absolutely absurd amount of scoring and skill. So to me, Tennessee is in the category of I would not be shocked if they made a Final Four. It's so hard to be like I guess I'd still be a little shocked if they won a championship because it's still like Rick Barnes and Tennessee. But like if you looked at their portal hall and it was like you could if there was somehow a way that you could look at a team's portal hall and not know where they were, it was just like blind portal rankings, I think anyone would look at that class and be like, yeah, that is like a team that could win the championship. So for that reason, I would have Tennessee in my tier one.
So they've almost done what Billy Donovan and John Beilein, I think, are the only people to do it right now. Like the four straight Elite Eights, like they're close. And I almost had him in my tier one. Like I have defensive questions. I do think Terrence Hill is a really good defender, but like I think Rick Barnes like knew that, and I think they kind of knew they had to have somebody at the point of attack that's like at least disruptive, right? Like they missed the Kai Ziegler so much last year in that way. But yeah, it's so interesting it'll be interesting to watch. Like I love this Juke Harris fit so much because he doesn't have to do all the stuff he had to do at Wake. Like he can just kind of be a guy. And as long as he accepts that, like it'll be the first time we watch a Rick Barnes team where like they don't have to go to Chaz Lanier. They don't have to go to Dalton Connect. They don't have to go to Nate Ament. Like, you know that you knew where the ball was going. And now, like, Rick Barnes has got some real options and versatility. And I think that's super interesting. So I had them in tier two. I could have put them in tier one. I've got Kentucky kind of safely in tier two because I don't, like, even if they add Mark Mitchell. Now, if they add Mark Mitchell, you know, I do think it raises their ceiling to like Final Four-ish ceiling because I think their front court becomes pretty awesome. And I love Zoom Diallo. I'm really interested in Fawcett's take on him. I think he's great. But I like kind of wonder, like the only role player that makes sense outside of their front court is like Cam Williams. Like, the rest of them are, like, all dudes that need the basketball. They have a bunch of ball-dominant guys, and I'm just like, how are they going to get this to work? Particularly, like, Wilkins and Diallo.
Yeah, it is hard. So, for those who have not watched, so, like, Zoom Diallo was on these absolutely disgraceful Washington teams the last 2 years, which, as much as people, like, everyone loves, like, killing Kentucky for how they had all this NIL and having a good relative to NIL. Washington has just been like in the market. They are the team. They are the program that has been the absolute worst with NIL. They have thrown around gigantic amounts of money and have just been completely irrelevant. And
that's a great take.
On one hand, Diallo is kind of the face of that now, rightfully so or not, because yeah, he has his moments. He was also the best player on a team that had a lot of talent around him and they were god awful. So it's always hard to know exactly what to like. I struggle with that one. And then I do think that kind of an interesting pickup was Alex Wilkins, was this 6'5" freshman from Furman that is like really interesting. His like counting stats are really big. A lot of the advanced stats don't like him. So a lot of the like, a lot of the khakis who have the portal services didn't like him, but like, I actually like, I like what I see with him. So like, we'll see. So maybe he's underrated, but yeah, I don't know about the piece. I kind of want to have them like, I kind of want to have them tier three, but I know by doing so it's a hot take and therefore I know they belong tier two, if that makes sense. I'm also sure if Momčilović is like obviously that was a desperation kind of move and he leveraged them to all heavens to go there. But that's still just like that genre of player, I'm not sure is like the ceiling raiser that they even needed. So yeah, once again, I know people, I wish I was stronger in my convictions last year talking about how I really hated how Kentucky put their roster together, kind of hinted at it, never like fully stood in the paint. I don't feel as strongly about how like that thinking the roster construction is poor, but I will say adamantly, I still do not think this is a super well constructed roster for a Kentucky for, but yeah, probably like the bottom end of tier two. And like, again, I see it. So in Neil's tier, there's Kentucky and Tennessee. Like to me, Tennessee is just like mogging them in that spot. I feel like Tennessee is much, much better than Kentucky in my opinion. But again, that's just like, that's even again, like I would say like maybe Texas is in my tier two, still same thing. I'd have them like way above. So almost I feel like there needs to be like even smaller tiers, but that's kind of what Kentucky represents to me.
My ESPN radio in Atlanta take on Momčilović was that I'm not sure that made them better than re-signing Chandler would have.
Mm.
And I think I got a lot of not happy, a lot, like eight. I got like eight unhappy emails about that by people who actually looked up my email address and sent me notes about how I don't know anything. And like, it's embarrassing that they had me on ESPN radio. And I just said, like, Momčilović does one thing, and he does it really, really, really well. And, like, I think Chandler does everything else better than him. And, like, you know, yeah, like, there's going to be gravity there. And, like, if you have a guy like Wilkins who can drive, I think he needs the ball a lot, Eric. But, like, if you have a guy like that who can get to the basket, you have a guy like Zoom Diallo who can get to the basket, you know, neither of them shoot great, but you know, you get a lot of gravity out of Momčilović, right? Wherever you put him. But you know, like Chandler made like multiple plays last year that won games defensively. Like Momčilović isn't doing that. You know, Chandler grabbed 5.5 rebounds a game in SEC play. Like, you think Momčilović is going to get to 5.5 per an SEC play? Maybe, like if they play fast, you know, I don't know. It's interesting to me because, like you said, they had to get a name, and they got a name. I'm just not sure how much better he makes them. My third tier was Vanderbilt, Arkansas, and Alabama. Of those three teams, I like Vanderbilt the best. I'm in the minority, I think, nationally on that. I keep hearing that Tyler Tanner doesn't have a lot of help. I think that's a lazy take. I think Chandler Bing is like Isaiah Brown, a guy that could make a huge leap. I really like him. And I loved what they did in the portal. I thought they got way better in the front court. They're going to be way more multiple around Tyler Tanner this year. I almost put them in tier two, but that would have been a hot take to Fawcett's point. So I put them at the top of tier three. Of those three teams, the team I trust the least is Arkansas, because I just like, if you look at the SEC, the league is so old again. And like, you could love Jordan Smith more than any freshman in the country, and John Calipari is still going to start four freshmen, man. Like, I just think it's going to be tough for them at times.
Yeah, I agree with Arkansas. This is where I feel like I almost want to, like, I would split my tiers a little bit more than you, where I almost, like, I'd almost have Florida, Tennessee in my tier one, Texas alone in tier two. Then in tier three, I'd have Kentucky, Vanderbilt, and Alabama. So Vanderbilt is just such a tough one too, when you look at, like, this is a team that finished. I mean, I actually forget. Let me just look it up really quick. But obviously, like, did really well. Vanderbilt finishes 11th in KenPom. Yes, they lose Duke Miles and a couple of pieces, like Duke Miles being the biggest. But like, it's not like they like they still have Tyler Tanner. And then I think bring in like Ace Glass, who I like, and T.O. Barrett's like a proven SEC guy. They got better in the front court. Their front court's not great, but like Burke Buchtenzel can shoot. What's his name? The Colorado guy he's like the lob catcher that they didn't have. And then they got the kind of 6'8" physical Auburn front court player who just brings some of the size they need. So it's definitely probably a little bit of a coaching and Tanner thing for me to have them there. But I also just look at last year and I'm like, well, they didn't lose enough and not replenish it enough to be like expecting them to go from 11th in KenPom to like 22nd, in my opinion. And like, when we're looking at these teams on range, like that would be so I still am high in Vanderbilt. And then Alabama, who people will probably remember. I feel like I'm always higher on Alabama than consensus, but this year too, especially, like, it's also funny. They brought in Drew Fielder, who's kind of considered to be the best true, like, traditional stretch five from Boise State. I don't love that genre of player. And I wouldn't have put all my kind of eggs in that basket. But again, he's kind of a important piece. But then they also got Jamarion Davis Fleming and Brandon Garrison, two just like proven big body fives that they could have desperately used the last couple of years. So I think that they're just ability to create driving lanes for Holloway and like Allen and Bristow driving downhill. And they have like the size at the five position that they desperately need. Yeah, and if Fielder's and I'm not even like really expecting a big season from Fielder yet. Everyone else is expecting a huge season from Fielder. So if that happens or anything close to that, like, yeah, I think they could be pushing even like tier two ish. So yeah. And I would, yeah, share your opinion on Arkansas.
Anybody there in tier four or five you even want to talk about? Like Missouri, really good recruiting class. Again, kind of an interesting team. They're going to go to the NCAA tournament. I don't know like if I could put them any higher than the top of tier four, though. Porter Moser can coach. He likes his team. A&M, P.J. Haggerty. Georgia returns four starters. From a team that made the NCAA tournament. Like, this is how good the SEC is going to be, right? Like, Georgia returned four starters from an NCAA tournament team, and one of them, Kenan Ketchings, is probably a draft pick somewhere. And, like, I don't know. I just don't really trust Mike White and that staff to get what they need out of them. And I also just don't know if, like, returning – like, I love Blue Kane, but, like, returning Blue Kane and Kenan Ketchings, I don't know if I can get them out of tier four, right? Tier five, I'm pretty confident I'm right on tier five. I would get some pushback from people on Auburn, I'm sure. There are some people kind of like what they did. I don't know, man. And then LSU, like, you really can't – you can't make any arguments about LSU right now because I don't know, like, who's going to play for them.
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned it, like, months ago on the podcast that I was like, I don't think you people understand. If LSU gets ever ineligible, they're winning the national championship. Now we're at the point where, like, the names that were, like, the EuroLeague starters have already been, like, they're not eligible. Like, there's no way.
Right.
So they're so I know I just wanted to, like, kind of update people because at one point we were looking at the roster with four guys and I was like, no, you guys don't really – like, they're going to win the national championship if everyone gets eligible. And now – and that was, like, people might have thought I was exaggerating. I truly believe that. However, with now that the top-end guys of that have been lopped off – now their ceiling is not even close to that. So that's one of the things too, where like, I still think I could see a world where if some of their guys get eligible, they could be like a tier three team and surprise some people. But like, I kind of feel like that's their ceiling. Their ceiling is no longer Final Four, win a championship, which I probably shouldn't have even entertained because when it was like, yeah, Madar, like there was no chance. I shouldn't have even entertained it, to be honest. But I think at that point early in the off season, I'm like, hell, anything's possible. So we're like, we'll see. So yeah, that's what I feel about LSU. And then to me, the most interesting roster would just be Texas A&M, because on one hand, I thought it was interesting where maybe this isn't the total fair comparison, but like when Shaka Smart takes Texas, everyone is like, oh, is he going to still do the Havoc thing? Because if you're going to do the Havoc thing, you need to recruit a certain style of guy. But if you go to Texas, you probably need to recruit five stars. And there's always just that, like with guys that play the like pressing styles, there's always that push and pull about like, if you're playing that style, you probably need guys that aren't conventionally talented and you need to get some kind of other pieces. And with some of the takes, that's what Bucky McMillan did this year, which he didn't really do the first year. He kind of still got like talent last year. This year, he definitely got some guys that are not going to jump off the page, but are guys that he feels will execute that style and will play really hard for 40 minutes and press and trap. And some of his centers are like 6'8 and 210, so they're undersized, but they're going to be able to sprint around and fly around and do the trapping. So on one hand, I'm like, oh, that's actually just like really interesting. I'm really curious to see how that kind of works. But then he went and got, getting PJ Haggerty, like you mentioned, getting Jordan Pope. Like, he got guys that are more conventional, just like scoring pieces on top of that. So part of me is like, oh, if like Jalen Reese and Jalen Shelley and like Tyshawn Archie and these like low major, mid major guys, like just like guard like demons, and then Haggerty just runs around and scores 25 points a game, which he has shown the ability to do. It's kind of interesting to me. So I just don't know what to think about Texas A&M, but like, I'm just not really interested by Oklahoma, Georgia, Auburn, like those. I'm just, yeah. Mississippi State, like, just doesn't interest me. Whereas I will say I'm at least interested by Texas A&M. I'm not saying I think they're going to finish higher. They absolutely belong in the tier you have them. I would just say that's like, if you're looking at the one team that could maybe surprise, I would say that that's probably Texas A&M. Then maybe the other one would just be Auburn, because like, I think they technically have talent, but like, I'm with you. I'd have them tier five. Like, I did not like what I saw last year. Not that they're super talented. Like, I'm not saying they're like tier two talent, but like, yeah, maybe they're lower end tier three, upper tier four talent, but it just obviously didn't come together last year. So like, what am I to expect? So I would agree with you on all your final fours. I think my only disagreements with you, I would say, is I would have Tennessee tier one. I would break up the tiers, like I said, which maybe like sorts things out a little bit. But generally speaking, we're in the same kind of boat. And I think that probably LSU is going to land in tier four when they get some of their guys eligible.
That's totally fair. I thought about it a little more because you mentioned the most interesting to you. So maybe that's a good way of approaching four and five. Like, Missouri is the most interesting to me. Like, Jason Crow Jr., I think is going to be spectacular. I love Bryson Tiller. I've always been a Bryson Tiller guy. And like, I feel like that, and like, if you get like a good version of Kennard Davis, Trent Pierce is a guy who's been around a while. Like, he's a pain in the butt to play against. Like, I think Condon said like he was like his least favorite front court dude to play because he's kind of a dark arts guy that's always poking you, and you know, he just kind of gets under your skin a little bit. Like, Jalen Carey is there, who, you know, I like Jalen offensively. You know, I don't know if Dennis can get him to compete on the other end. You know, like we saw last year, I mean, he just flat out quit against Florida in the Ruben Chinulu game. But yeah, I mean, we'll see. Like, Missouri is interesting to me just because you add like a top 10 freshman and you put some pretty good pieces around him. You know, who knows? We saw Arkansas, that worked for them last year. But that's it. That's all I had.
Do you have any, you know, everyone loves the I actually hate these questions, but I'll throw it to you anyways because I know people love them. It's mostly because it's so hard to say. Like, people always look at a league and they're like, Neil, how many NCAA tournament teams are there? Which is always like, but people always view it like this, looking at one team's league, when you really have to factor in, like, is the A-10 going to steal bids? Is the Mountain West going to steal bids? How good is it? So that's why I hate these questions, but I'll ask it to you anyways, because I bet there's someone thinking, Neil, how many NCAA tournament teams are there going to be from the SEC?
With the expanded field, I think 13. If it were 68, I would have said 12. but with the expanded field, I think it's 13 because, like, and I've already mentioned, like, Auburn. Like, I think Auburn, like, sneaks in and gets in, and that's 13. Ole Miss, Miss State, South Carolina are playing at home. And by the way, like, this is how good the league – like, South Carolina's roster does not suck. Like, if you put South Carolina's roster in not the Big Ten or the Big 12 – actually, not the Big Ten. I got to think about that one. But I think if you put it in the Big East, it would finish in the top five. I really think that. And I mean, I just, this is going to be a monstrous year for the SEC. I think 15-3 might win the league.
Yeah, actually, South Carolina might be in the category of like just they're. I guess they're not quite interesting to me, and the style they play is just not. It's not going to be appointment television for me. But yeah, I don't think they're finishing last in the league. I think that they'll be in that 12 right. or 13 range, and yeah, on the bubble, which is again going to be interesting. And I think that you mentioned Auburn sneaking in. Like I was not a proponent of expanding the field. I'm not like the world is the sky is falling. I do think it could be like, it could be more damaging. I think there's going to be a lot of casual fans that are just going to care less and less about the sport until March, because this is going to really like the people that are like college basketball doesn't matter until March are kind of going to be proven right. When they see that a team that's 12th in the SEC or 13th in the SEC is making the tournament, that is only going to confirm what a lot of critics of the sport say, but it'll also be interesting. One thing I'm looking forward to is like, yeah, like what is the job security like for what happens if Auburn is in the first eight or whatever they're calling it? They make the NCAA tournament, but barely, you know, what does and you're going to start to see some of those tough decisions on coaches. So that'll be interesting too.
All right. Go to patreon.com/FloridaBBHour. Subscribe. Best way to support us. Lots of stuff coming up. I'm going to drop something tonight. Actually, you know, Friday night. Why not? And then we'll just go from there. I'll let Fawcett sign us off.
Go Gators and keep attacking closeouts.
Hey, thanks for
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.